Well, welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. Our guest is Elizabeth Payne Rosen, who's the author of a new novel set in Civil War times, and it's called Helm's War. Betsy Rosen was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. She worked in New York City, lived for 13 years in London with her husband, Martin Rosen, who's a film and theater producer. And now she's a hospital chaplain in Marin County, California. So, what are the Chapel Hill connections that bring her here? And I think, Betsy, you're a Carolina mom. Is that right?
No. In a way. My daughter worked in Chapel Hill for a while.
She was like a student in Chapel Hill and worked in... Where did she work?
She worked at a restaurant.
I can't remember the name of it.
But her other claim to fame, in a strange way, I hadn't thought about this till this moment, is that she was married to Ben Folds of Ben Folds 5. So your younger listeners will know what that means.
Well,
unfortunately, it didn't last, but they're still great friends, and we're crazy about Ben.
Well, you got another important connection to Chapel Hill, which is sort of a Highlands College or Highlands University assemblage, not in exile, but in happy association down here. And our folks love Lee Smith, Wyndham Robertson, Shannon Ravenel, and others who are all sort of patrons of the godfather of this mafia group, Lewis Rubin, who's the wonderful writing teacher. And as such, you have a wide audience of people who have welcomed you to Chapel Hill as if you were a native. And so we declare you to be an adopted daughter of Chapel Hill.
Well, that's good. I accept, and I'm flattered. Especially with, as you say, with Wyndham and Shannon, of course, was very important in the publication of my book, which I'll talk about in a minute, maybe.
Well, that'd be great. Your book is what we really want to talk about, and it's called Hallam's War. It is a Civil War book, and I'm going to want you to talk about it and tell us all about it, but... Golly, can I call you Betsy?
Yes, please.
Is that okay?
Betsy is good.
Betsy Rosen's book, Helm's War, is, you know, you're tempted to say it's another Civil War book, another novel. And we're thinking about in North Carolina, Cold Mountain, which is another novel set in Civil War times with the Charleston connection. Why do we need another one?
Well, I didn't start off thinking we needed another one. Like most writers, I just had to write another one. I was fascinated first with the war itself. It wasn't as if I started off saying, I want to write a Civil War novel. I was a Civil War nut. I was living in England, and one day I was a young mother, and walking past the Duke of York's barracks on the King's Road and spilled my groceries. And as I was picking them up, I became absolutely overwhelmed with this idea that I wanted to know everything there was to know about the American Civil War. I call it the American Civil War because
they
have their own one.
American, a Southern girl, exiled, married and living in London, and all of a sudden... Is it like an epiphany? I mean, you just kind of...
Well, I do sometimes like say I was called to the Civil War. It was
right there on your knees with picking up groceries. I mean, really,
like
are you making that up or is that
no,
real?
No, that really happened, and I really did come home immediately to our flat, put the groceries down in the kitchen, didn't even unpack them. And I thought, Martin has a book about the Civil War somewhere, and I found it. I believe it was the first volume of Bruce Catton's Centennial Trilogy. And I just never looked back. And I was just became obsessed with the Civil War, which is unusual for a woman, I think, although there are some crazy people like me. But there's plenty of men and women as well who know exactly what I'm talking about. You just become, it's like being a golf widow or something.
What is it? I mean, in the days immediately after the Civil War, in the 20 and 30 years with women who'd lost their husbands or their boyfriends or their children or their brothers in the war, and there was this whole reflection on, well, maybe we should have won or maybe it was the lost cause. There was all of this, which led us as Southerners to kind of look for something about the Civil War that we could think about. But now, isn't it? That's all gone now, isn't it? I mean, that's...
Well, you would think so. And my mother, for example, who grew up in Monroe, Louisiana, with, you know, probably there were still veterans, old men still talking about it, she didn't like the idea that I got so interested in it. Her feeling was, let's let go of that. Let's get past that. Let's move mm-hmm. forward and not... So I really have no explanation of it, particularly... Of my interest in it, particularly since at the time I was a peacenik. I was against the Vietnam War. I'm an anti-war person in general. I have never been interested in strategy or board games that include strategy, and yet I was attracted to the military aspects of the war. And as I sort of unpack that now, all these years later, I realized that, and this was when this first happened to me, it was just as the women's movement was happening, and I was living in London. I have never talked about this before, actually. It's coming to me as I'm saying it. And I think that part of it was that maybe some of your listeners will know a book that has always been one of my favorite books called The Scottish Chiefs. It had wonderful NCYF illustrations. And no one else ever heard of this. I loved this book. And then years later, I read in The New Yorker that Barbara Tuchman, the great historian, said that that was the book that turned her into an historian. It's all about Robert the Bruce and William Wallace and all those things that the Mel Gibson Braveheart movie was about. But the illustrations were profoundly... influential in my life, as I believe children's books illustrations are
very big. These pictures, along with the narrative of the historic, the heroes of Scotland.
And the weird thing
throwing
was,
off the oppression of those...
Well, yes, partly that. Of course, there was this Southern thing about Sir Walter Scott and all those kinds of things. But the pictures, the NCYF full-page color pictures, one of them was of William Wallace, the great Scottish hero, standing at the top of a crag with rainbow rays shooting out behind him, his golden locks waving in the wind. He's holding up his sword. His kilt is blowing in the wind. And something in me responded to that terrifically. Not to when his wife was killed by the dastardly English and she's lying in her beautiful dress under the tree. And that I also responded to that because I like beautiful dresses and romantic scenes. But I responded on a very deep and passionate level to that those pictures of really battle. And so I've thought about this a lot. I thought it is innate in the human nature to compete and to fight and to have physical contact in that fighting. So I always think, what can we do to take the place of war? I used to think it was organized sports until when I was living in England, there was that enormous soccer riot somewhere in South America and like 30 people were killed. And I thought, well, maybe that's not it either. But I feel that, just speaking for myself, that there is some aggression in me. You know, that I never did sports. I was just this Southern girl that lounged around reading comic books and things. But what is it in me that responded to William Wallace risking his life? I think that's what it was. When you're an idealistic person who has deep beliefs about what you believe in, you want to be tested. You want to say, what does it feel like? And men, I think, always think this. Men always think this. Whether it's war stories or whether it's, superhero stories. What does it feel like to be in that moment where your life is at stake? Would you die for something? Would you be a coward? What would you do? And I think that is what accounts for the fact that my book, in addition to being a Civil War novel about characters and people and families and relationships, has a lot of war and battles in it.
Well, we're talking to Elizabeth Payne Rosen about her new book, Hallam's War, which is set in Civil War times, and she's told us a little bit about how she happened to write the book. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, she'll tell us about the book. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Elizabeth Payne Rosen, and she's written a new book, about set in Civil War times. It's kind of a special book, and it's called Hallam's War. So how do we start? Will you tell us a little bit about your one of your main characters, maybe I think the main character, but that's arguable, Hugh Hallam, who gave the title, I think,
right,
to Hallam's War.
Yes.
Who's this guy?
He is a West Point graduate, a Mexican war officer who resigned his commission after the war and took a land grant and is growing cotton in West Tennessee. The story opens in 1859, and he is riding out early in the morning before dawn. I think maybe I'll actually read that scene. He's riding out in the morning just to sort of check on everything. If your listeners are from a farming background at all, as I am, you'll know that you have to go out, whether it's today in a pickup truck or on a horse, as Hugh was, and what happened during the night? What happened to the livestock? Did any of the fences blow down? Whatever it was. So Hugh Hallam and his wife, Serena, who is from a wealthy family in Charleston and fell madly in love with Hugh. They have three children. But she followed him out to West Tennessee, which at the time was really the wilderness. I mean, people were still carving farms out of the primeval forest. And
Betsy, I hate to interrupt you about this, but we talked about this before we went on the air, but or maybe earlier, but well, this evokes the memory of our Coal Mountain story, where you have a Charleston woman who
I had forgotten.
Reasons of not of altogether of her own making is plucked up and put sort of on the frontier,
right,
and wrestling with all of these things.
I have to say that I wrote my book about 20 years before that.
I remember
that.
No, I'm not apologetic about asking the question, because as you'd mentioned in your visits earlier, this book that you wrote was finished before Charles Frazier even started his book. So you didn't copy him. He didn't copy you.
Have to say parenthetically that I thought that was a brilliant book.
Yeah.
I mean, so if anyone compares me to Coal Mountain, I'm very flattered.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
But there is this... there is something special in about the South, and that is our putting one part of it, which is sort of the Charleston model of the dresses and the, you know, all of this high society, versus what is really, I don't want to call it redneck frontier, but it is rough, tough. And you just have to be a tougher person, and there's not as much room for the niceties, at least on the real frontier.
So that was Hugh, again, testing himself. As men do, or certain kinds of men.
He said, I'm not going to take it like it is. I'm going to go out and make my own way.
Exactly. His own father had ruined their tobacco farm back in Virginia by just growing it into the ground, not replenishing the soil. So he's going to do it differently. And he's a modern farmer for his time, and reads all the agricultural journals, and is determined to rotate his crops and turn his peas and beans under to fix the nitrogen in the soil and all that sort of thing. And that's not what was happening in general. People were raising cotton in vast quantities. It was an enormously saleable item at the time, so the cotton was the cash economy of the South. To grow cotton, you had to have slaves, and the more cotton you grew, the more slaves you had to buy to farm it. Now, Hugh Hallam is a person who likes working, unlike most white Southern men who really despise the idea of getting their hands dirty at all. So that makes him different right away. And he's the one behind the plow at planting time, for example. And he has about 20 slaves, which by those standards was a very small number, but is a legitimate kind of person that we rarely hear about. We hear about Tara and Gone with the Wind, or we hear about the really subsistence farmers, very, very small farmers who own no slaves at all. But Hugh, I didn't set out to sort of make him an example of something. He just came into my mind, and that's the kind of man he was, and I thought that's what he would have been doing.
Well, I think you describe him pretty well in this opening scene.
All right. It's late May. The early morning darkness reminded Hugh Hallam of Mexico. Then, as now, he had saddled his horse before dawn and ridden out while the others slept to survey the territory around San Agustin before the day's assault and get the feel of the land in his bones. He wondered why he should think of the war now, when peace lay over the fields and the heat of the day was still a long way off. Beyond the fences, the cotton lay in dark, leafy rows in the fading starlight, nothing like the stony wasteland of the Pedregal 14 years ago, before the battle that would rage all day towards Churubusco. Behind him in the silent house, his wife Serena would have drowsed back into sleep by now. They had made love early while it was still cool. He remembered her body on the bare sheets, the heat and softness of her skin. No smoke arose from the brick kitchen as he rode by. Marky was not yet up. He had drunk a cup of cold water from the cistern on his way out. The moon had set by the time he closed the last gate behind him and headed out towards the orchard, past the long, low house and through the two short lines of slave cabins. He had built the first of them himself, his only shelter that first winter in Tennessee, when he'd left Serena and the children behind and come out ahead to clear the land. The others he had added as necessity had dictated over the years. They were small, plain structures, but of good quality by the standards of the neighborhood. He had allowed his slaves to build their own chimneys of solid brick, purchased by himself at the Masons, and not the usual wattle and daub that managed to catch fire once or twice a year. Each cabin had a small yard where its inhabitants could keep chickens or tend a patch of greens. Five of the cabins were silent and dark now, their narrow doors open to catch the coolness of the night air. In them, 20 people, 8 men, 6 women, and 6 children, slept the deep sleep of physical exhaustion from which the iron triangle hanging in the plane tree would soon awaken them for another day's labor in the fields. A dog, hearing the horse, rose from the ground and growled from the end of his rope, then smelled the man's familiar smell and padded back to his station near the door. In the 6th cabin, a candle burned. French would be awake, studying the advertising circulars he had picked up yesterday in Kinloch. Hallam paused in front of his door, then resisted the impulse to intrude. It would be a long day. Let him have his privacy before it began. His mind went back to the day in March, 3 years ago, when he had first seen the slave who now sat reading by candlelight. Then I'll skip a little bit and continue reading. There is a slave trader who comes through the neighborhood with a small group of trade of slaves heading south, which, of course, the farther south you went, if you came from the upper south, the worse it was for you. If you made it as far as the sugar plantations of South Louisiana, it was virtually a sentence of death. So Hugh is riding with his neighbor, Ross McWhirter, who is the sort of villain of the book, a very much darker character who farms quite differently from Hugh and treats his own slaves quite differently. The dealer had accepted McWhirter's offer of a glass of whiskey on the back porch, and left to inspect the slaves alone, Hallam approached the man who had first attracted his attention. He was fit-looking and muscular enough, impossible for a seasoned field hand not to be, but without the spectacular physique that would fetch the highest prices on the block. His features were very African, with the broad nose and bloodshot eyes of the Igbo tribe, and he was marked across his left cheek with a long, diagonal scar. Hallam assumed he had come from one of the slave ships that continued to operate clandestinely since the trade was outlawed 50 years before, yet when questioned, the man answered briefly but perfectly intelligibly in the accent of the Virginia Tidewater, saying he'd been born in 1825 on a farm near the headwaters of the York River. Aside from a certain wiry alertness in the way he held himself, not unusual for a slave in the presence of a possible new master, there was nothing to indicate why he should have been sold south. "Better take his shirt off, Hallam," McWhirter called out good-naturedly from the porch. The dealer, noticing for the first time that his goods were under inspection, finished his drink and, hurrying over to where Hallam stood, tried to divert his attention to an enormous Negro standing at the opposite end of the line. "If you're looking for value, mister, I got a nigger over here that wouldn't sell for less than $2,000 at open auction, 6 feet 2 inches tall and his work in prime and strong as a team of mules." Hallam looked in the direction the man indicated, seeing a tall, muscular, medium-skinned Negro who straightened his shoulders as he stood, but turned back to the slave who stood in front of him. "I'd like to see this man with his shirt off," he said. "This one here, sir?" Seeing that Hallam would not change his mind, the dealer came and stood behind him. "Turn around, boy," he said. The slave kicked his chain clear with one bare foot and prepared to turn, but for a moment, before he obeyed the slaver's command, he looked up and met Hallam's gaze, met it levelly, not defiant, but not subservient either. And in that moment, Hallam saw clearly what he would never forget, saw a man like himself, near his own age, born into the same century in the same part of the world, a man with an inner life as private and complex as his own. He was never again to recognize it so plainly face to face, and as events came to cloud the future of both men, would come to doubt the evidence of his memory. But for that one moment he had seen, and that made all the difference.
Now, Elizabeth Payne Rosen, whom we call Betsy, has just read a substantial part of the introduction of her new book, Hallam's War, set in the Civil War times, and you very seldom have a Civil War book that starts out so, how do you say, maybe just so brutally with the institution of slavery and how it works. Why are the opening passages that you read to us so important for us, either to understand the book or to get interested in the book? These are important parts for you, aren't they?
Yeah. I will say this, that in the first draft of the novel written 20 years or more ago, that passage came at about page 70. But three important people, three important readers of mine, after having read the manuscript, said, would you think about opening with that scene? It gets more harrowing after what I've just read. And I wanted to do that because it sets the scene both in terms of the plot and in terms of the moral complications of the story. So I feel that if you don't like that opening scene, you're not going to get past it. You probably won't. But if you do, if that gets your attention and you think that is something that makes you want to think more, then you will go on. My idea, I think, not absolutely consciously when I began this book all those years ago, but pretty consciously, one of the many things that made me want to write it was to think, how could a good man or a good woman have owned slaves? How could that be? You know? So I wanted to put myself back in that situation with a sort of innocent eye and explore what that felt like to be a person who was absolutely complicit in the slave economy and yet was not themselves a bad person, was a thoughtful person. How did they feel about this? And so as the story goes on and we see the relationship between Hugh and French and between Hugh and his neighbor Ross McWhorter and their wives and children, and it kind of goes out from there, and we see it opens 2 years before the war starts. It opens in 1859, and then the next major section starts in 1861 when he was already the colonel of a Tennessee regiment.
Well, there's a lot of history just on this campus at Chapel Hill about people who are good people, in quotes, maybe take quotes away too, who were slave owners and advocates for the system, the economic system and the social system of which slavery was a part. And some of them have their names on the buildings of the campus. And so
look at Brown University. The great-granddaughter of that family has now written a book that's just coming out now about how her family's fortune, this northern family, is all based on the slave trade.
Yeah.
And she didn't know that, and she's investigating that now. So, you know, sounds like she's doing the same thing I'm doing, trying to figure it out. And I do want to say one thing, DG. When I say a good man, this is not the story of one of those mythical good masters. Hugh is a fair master. I think if he was your employer, you would think he was a decent employer. But he is, as I said, fully a part of the system, and so he has this responsibility. He is not an innocent.
Well, let me just say that wrestling with those questions ourselves about our ancestors or the people who were leaders whom we're following, that we are, some of us, looking for ways in which we can understand and appreciate how they viewed things. Mm-hmm. Well, we try to put ourselves in the context of those times and wonder whether we would have done something a little bit differently. But what I guess the question is this an apology for Hugh Hollam and those others who were slave owners? Is that
not at all? Not at all. That's the farthest thing from my mind. I would be appalled if anyone came away from my book with that idea. I think it
is it a condemnation of them?
No, well, it's neither one. It's just an exploration of it. I mean, people are complex. And my black characters, my slave characters are complex as well. They're not all good people wearing halos. They have different personalities and react to the same events in different ways. And that's just my experience of human nature.
We're talking to Betsy Payne, Elizabeth Payne Rosen, about her new book, Hallam's War. We're going to continue that discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Elizabeth Payne Rosen. She is the author of Hallam's War. It's a new book, and we're talking to her not only about the story of the book, but the challenge of writing a novel about the Civil War that has an appeal and a message to modern readers. And Betsy Payne, were you writing this for modern readers, or were you just writing it for yourself?
I was writing it for modern readers in terms of just always hoping that you find that you're telling a story that someone wants to hear, that it's just a good story. But as I said, I wrote it many years ago and put it under the bed for 10 years and just brought it out again 3 years ago. So it is pure serendipity that it is coming out and it has been published right now when the situation in our country now seems to me very similar to that of 1859, when we're in a polarized situation. We are red state, blue state, right and left. People have kind of withdrawn to their corners and have been projecting their, you know, you're the evil one and you're the good one onto whichever side they believe. And I feel like we are lucky enough to be living right now in a situation where some of the things that have been nailed down for 150 years are coming a little bit loose and are starting to move around.
What are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the presidential election right now and how the issue of race is coming up in a completely new way. I mean, I think after Barack Obama's speech in Chicago about race, it was like, oh, my goodness, are we actually going to talk about this? Which was, I thought, just mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And I think everything is kind of opened up now. And I don't know who is going to win this race or who should win it. I have my own views. But we're in a new conversation that has not, in my view, ever happened before in this country,
and the way it is now. And does your book have a message for us for these
times?
But
I don't like to think that I have a message. I don't like books to have messages.
There's no moral. There's no moral to this book. Then there you
are. Well, you're pinning me down. Of course, I believe there's a moral. I'm a moral person.
What is the moral?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you that. No way. You're not going to get me there. I just think the moral of it. Well, okay. I'll say this. I think the moral of it is that we should not assume we know other people. People are profound mysteries. Each human being. And I think that we get into trouble as a society or as a small local community projecting our own fears and horrors and hatreds onto other people as a block. And because the more we do that, the less we understand them and the more we get just entrenched in our own beliefs. And sometimes people's beliefs don't change after they're about 20 years old.
Well, that's right. Well, you introduced us in a passage that you read earlier to French, who is an enslaved African-American and is owned by your lead character, Hugh Hallam. And French is an extraordinarily complex character you're talking about, but hard to know, mm-hmm. hard for anybody to know. And tell us how you constructed this character and what did you mean by him?
French was always there. He was always there with Hugh and Serena. He was just there.
I mean, he was smart. He could read. He could manage. He right. was, in some respects, superior in talent and judgment to any of your other, in many respects, to any of your other characters, and yet he's a slaveholder, and he's got some, he's not all good. I mean, he's not all...
Well, he's mysterious, let's say that. And he doesn't talk much. He when the story opens, Hugh has owned him for 3 years and probably, certainly spends more time with him than he does anybody else in his life, and knows him better and feels more known by French. And yet they hardly ever speak, except it's just in half sentences. He tells French what needs to be done in the morning, and he can be absolutely certain that at the end of the day it will be done. And he has that, French has that sort of natural authority, which Hugh also has, and I think they recognize that in each other.
Was French an extraordinary character in terms of the average enslaved person in those times, as far as you can tell from your research? Or were there many people enslaved who had these kinds of extraordinary talents, both in terms of intellect and also managerial capability?
I can only assume that there was the same spread of intelligence and gifts in the slave population as there was in any other population. French knows how to read. That makes a huge difference. And so if to be a person who is a thoughtful person, who we think of as sort of intelligent and civilized, requires a certain amount of spare time, which not many slaves had. They're working hard. But then I always go back to Jefferson saying that his ideal was the yeoman farmer, who he thought was the sort of unit of democracy, because he had time as he's plowing his land all day to think. And so maybe it was that the slaves actually were thinking and having their own thoughts. They didn't have a huge vocabulary, literally, but they had their own vocabulary and began, and didn't begin. It was just the continuation of their culture. And so I don't know. I doubt whether many people were like French, because he had a certain amount of education, and that we know was not usual.
Well, that's an interesting point. I don't want to divert you from the discussion that we've had about having about this really extraordinarily interesting character. But one of the challenges that you had, and one of the challenges that a white person has to face who tries to write African-American dialect.
Yes.
And I wonder what your challenges have been, and whether anybody has challenged you or criticized you about this.
I've had a couple of reviews that have said things like, other people are going to get into trouble. And I know that I've always been aware that to write the black characters in dialect and the white characters not is essentially unfair. But since the white dialogue is by far the greatest part of the book, I just couldn't have done that. And also the white characters who speak in a kind of backwoods way are written in dialect as well. But I think it was kind of, I wrote people who were more educated spoke in a more educated way. But, of course, I didn't write in their accents. I didn't write in the way we Southerners make a single syllable into three. You know, yes.
No. Well, you know, it is, and this is where I want to go, basically, is understanding this risk that other people might criticize you about this. Well, you must have to go to extraordinary lengths to be sure that your writing of the dialect is not stylized, but is actually based on what we know African-Americans how do you do that?
I just went by the way the black people I know in northern Louisiana and the Mississippi
and
Delta.
And you just assume that's the way that the West Tennessee African-Americans
talk? Well, it's pretty close, because the West Tennessee and the Delta are kind of part of, you know, that's where all my family's from. So I think I have had really, really good feedback from white people saying, that's exactly right, you got it just right. I haven't heard any black people come back to me and say, that's not the way we sound at all. But I haven't really had any problem with this in other reviewers. I do want to say one thing about, I'm a great D.H. Lawrence fan, and was in college. And then we moved to England, and I remember thinking about Lawrence writing about how his coal miners spoke in the North Country of England. And I thought, gosh, Lawrence is such a fabulous writer, but he has a tin ear for dialogue. Nobody in the world sounds like that. And then when I got there, and we spent 6 weeks in Derbyshire, and you read it out loud, the way he'd written it was exactly right. So if I just challenge anyone who has a problem with the dialect that I've written to say whether they think
go prove it.
Just say it to yourself in your head and see if it maybe doesn't sound right.
Right. We're going to take a quick break. Elizabeth Payne Rosen is talking to us about her new book set in Civil War times called Hallam's War. We've left out a lot of the military parts of this book, and we'll talk a little bit about that after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Elizabeth Payne Rosen, who's in the Chapel Hill area visiting with many of her friends from Highlands College days who've come to Chapel Hill and talking to us about her book, new book, set in Civil War times called Hallam's War. And, you know, we've talked about Hallam and we've talked about other things and him as a farmer, but we hadn't talked much about the war and we don't have much time. What's special about your book as a Civil War book?
The thing that's special about it is that I chose a single campaign to follow from beginning to end, hoping that people who were not interested in Civil War history would be carried along by the story and the characters and sort of get some stealth history. So I took what was called the War in the West, meaning west of the Appalachian Mountains and east of the Mississippi, and it's the first year and a half of the war with the northern forces coming down the Mississippi Valley and up the inland rivers of Tennessee and culminating in the Battle of Shiloh in northern Mississippi. So this was the first enormous battle of the war, fought with two amateur armies in vast carnage and slaughter in that battle.
And so we can follow the war. There are several aspects of it that were interesting to me, and one of them, in addition to this awful carnage at Shiloh, were the, I don't want to call them the naval operations in the interior,
naval.
But the rivers played an interesting part in the campaign, didn't they?
A crucial part. Many people believe that the war, in effect, was lost in the West and continued on for another 2 years in the East because the Union Navy with gunboats came so swiftly right into the heart of the South. And it was, if you look at history in one way, it was kind of already all over at that point. Though
you could
that's
follow
not really
the,
true.
This is what you did for me, was that you could follow the Tennessee River, kind of going backwards from the Mississippi, and it goes south into Alabama and maybe even and all the way to Muscle Shoals so that it was navigable. And if you could control that, you get your gun butts. Boats up there, you had control.
Yes.
And the northern troops or the northern navy did that.
They did it. Yes.
Now, what happened in the West afterwards? You set your story on this small plantation or farm in West Tennessee. All of a sudden, that was either disputed territory or it was under the control of the Federal Army. And
well, what happened was, and this is covered in later parts of my books, is that a lot of people immediately started selling all their cotton to the North. And this was done through the Confederate government at times, too, because they needed the gold that the cotton would bring. So it was really amazing. More and more work is being done now to show how much trade there was between the two armies because they both had what the other one needed. So it was just kind of insane, really, because that was money that was keeping the war going in the East.
You show that we're compromisers. So
we are compromised.
Well, one of the things, now you're a hospital chaplain, and religion's got to be a very important part of your life. And how did religion fit into all of this?
Well, my daughter, who read it 3 years ago for the first time and is a wonderful writer herself, said, Mama, why didn't you put more about religion? It's the most important thing in your life. And until she said that, I didn't realize that I hadn't really. And yet, looking back on it, I think it's there.
There's this wonderful scene where Hallam kind of happens onto a camp meeting or preaching or an evangelism and is almost swept away. Almost swept away. He's almost saved, but he's not quite saved. I guess that was the thing. And I said, did she just drop that in there? What's all that about? Why was that in there?
I think that's in there. That's one of the scenes that came to me whole, just somewhere out of my rose from the depths of my imagination. But I think it's because it was not so much about religion. It was about a kinship with his neighbors and realizing that although he considered himself more sophisticated on one sense, that he had this deep thing in common, which was a sort of hospitality to each other and a deep
That's
connection.
So interesting to me. He was not susceptible to a life-changing moment religiously, but he was inspired and moved by the way that people were relating to each other in these circumstances. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's really amazing. What we just got a minute. What else? What have we missed? What do you want everybody to know about the book?
Serena.
Yeah,
well, I think of it.
In 30 seconds, tell us.
Well,
I wanted to ask, is this a man's book or a woman's book?
That was Serena is, I like to think of her as an absolutely equal protagonist with Hugh. But when I going around on this book tour and reading out sections, they all tend to be about Hugh, because Serena, and you could say this about women's lives in general, her scenes are just more woven in to the fabric of life with her husband, her children, her work, her gardening. She works in a hospital in Richmond towards the end of the book. And she and Hugh have a passionate and strong marriage. And they're not without their differences, but she's a strong character. And I want to be sure that people know she's there.
I just have to confess, I was swept away by Serena, and if anything, too perfect, because she just seemed to have every talent and every, except for a few little jealousies with her sister and everything. She just was just magnificent. Well, these are great characters, and we have just touched on them. They're other interesting characters, some of them famous and some of them maybe not quite as famous, but they're all interesting, and you've just done a great job bringing all of them together in your new book, Hallam's War, and you're wonderful to share it with us today here in Chapel Hill.
Well, thank you, DG. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much to Elizabeth Payne Rosen, the author of Hallam's War, for visiting with us today. Thanks to all y'all for listening, and we'll be back same time tomorrow.